Hello, everyone, and welcome to Science Unscripted. It is Connor here.
And Gabe.
And we have some science news for you today. Some of it is related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Most of it is not, because we have the pleasure of slowly addressing other scientific topics that aren't.
Yeah, there's some sleep research that'll be coming in at some point. Yeah. But first, the monster first.
Yeah, the beast in the corner. This question or this update is really about herd immunity and whether or when we could achieve it globally.
Yeah, that is a gigantic, probably unanswerable question right there. First of all, you'd have to vaccinate most of the globe, or at least a good percentage of the globe, between 70 and 90%. That's going to be hard to do. At this point, where are we at?
We are at roughly 5% of the globe has been vaccinated at this point. It's
600 million shots or something like that.
Yeah, or I should say 5% have had the full vaccination program.
That means 7 billion still have to get
roughly there. 1.9 or about 2 billion have had a shot at this point. Mm-hmm. Sounds good, because then you're at close to 2 billion shots. You're imagining close to 8 billion people, but the numbers are really skewed. So you've got, if you take China, India, and the United States, that's well more than a billion shots right there. And so the rest of the globe is really trying to vaccinate, but it's mostly happening in the big countries.
And that's the one question. The next question is, even if those people were to get those shots, would that be enough?
Even if every country around the globe could vaccinate at exactly the same rate with exactly the same vaccines, first of all, you probably wouldn't achieve that 60, 70% magic threshold for herd immunity, the idea that enough people are immunized, therefore stopping the out-of-control contagious spread of this virus. Because in many countries, you do have a lot of skepticism toward the vaccine. And so even if you got everyone who said they were planning to do it to come on in, you still may not reach that 60, 70% threshold. So that's one way of saying you should probably stop dreaming about herd immunity. According to Nature, the scientific journal that comes out weekly, they talked to 100 immunologists and asked them this question. How likely is it that herd immunity is going to happen? And 90% said it's either likely or very likely that that's never going to happen, or at least that SARS-CoV-2, this virus, is going to float around in pockets around the globe forever. And that's the way we should envision our future, is one where we live.
Okay, hold on. Is this the pandemic that is never going to go away, or is
something,
is it just going to be like the influenza virus
year? Something like the influenza virus.
I know
virus.
That we shouldn't be comparing those two viruses to each other, but in this respect, it's just going to come back every year in a different form?
So one thing that they actually, in this article in Nature, they came up with a very helpful graphic for kind of determining, because there are some unknowns. We don't know exactly what's going to happen in the coming years. But one of the first questions is, one thing we'll have to look at is, when we get vaccinated, is that immunity going to last forever? Or is it going to wane? Is it going to start to vanish over time? If our immunity starts to go down over time, then
you're
going
to... What kind of time?
Let's say 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 18 months later.
Yeah.
If you're not as immune to the same coronavirus as before, you're going to need that booster shot. If the answer is no, though, what if our immunity stays strong?
And there are signs that could definitely happen.
There are signs. Then the question is, will the virus continue to evolve, in pockets in countries around the world where that...
These variants popping up.
Yeah,
with that.
Exactly, new variants. Will it evolve to escape our immune system? So if the answer is yes, then... you're going to need some new vaccines, something basically a different formula. If the answer is no, and the virus is not going to evolve in a way that lets it get around our vaccines, well, then there's another question, which is one I wouldn't have necessarily thought of. Can the virus persist in animal reservoirs? And that's something we've known for a long, long time now, that there are, I believe, close to 100 animal species that can harbor this mm-hmm. virus. And if that's the case, then the virus could continue evolving amongst those animals, even if we were to, virtually wipe it out.
So constantly jumping back and forth between our species and some other species.
Yeah. And so to kind of summarize, there are a lot of different ways that our immunity can continue to change that would cause it to kind of keep coming back, flaring up, sometimes hot, sometimes mild.
And it all ends with an answer to your question from the beginning of the show. Are we going to reach herd immunity? Probably not.
Probably not. Don't expect it to be like that. Expect us to kind of live with the idea that just like flu vaccines exist, and, you know, they vary in effectiveness. Some years it's down to 10% efficacy. Some years it's over 50. You're going to get those booster shots. I'm going to get probably booster shots in the future to deal with the new variants of this virus.
Okay, so the coronavirus is never going away. We got that out of the way.
Good news.
And some more good news here. If you wake up 1 hour earlier in the morning, if you go to bed 1 hour earlier at night and wake up 1 hour earlier in the morning, your chance of becoming majorly depressed, major depressive disorder, goes down by 23%.
Hold on. If you're an early bird, go to bed early, wake up early.
Yeah.
Your risk of depression is 23% lower. If you're a night owl, you stay up late, wake up late.
Those are exactly the right terms. So the owls, the night owls among us, 23% more likely, and the larks or early morning risers, less likely.
Is that, hold on.
It's based on a huge study out of the University of Colorado, MIT, and Harvard. They were looking at 840,000 people, data from 840,000 people, including their genetic data.
It's not about me changing my behavior then. It's not about me, for example, I'm somebody who I would describe myself as more of a night owl.
Yeah.
And it's not the case then. If I see this information and I think, ooh, I shouldn't be a night owl anymore. I don't want a 23% higher risk of depression.
So I'm just going to go to bed 1 hour earlier and
wake
up.
Alarm.
And it's not that easy because there are genetic factors that determine that. Your circadian clock is a result of your genes. Whether you wake up in the morning an hour earlier or an hour later, that's already been decided almost.
So predetermined.
Yeah.
Okay, so Is one of the conclusions that you can draw from this analysis that I mean, we've seen this before, studies on school children and teenagers attending either middle school or high school, that their circadian rhythms really imply that they should be going to schools later than they are, waking up later, staying up later.
In a perfect world, they would be allowed to go to school later, yeah.
So in a perfect world, my genetic data could be looked at and they could clearly figure out that I'm a night owl and my whole schedule, my life schedule, from the time I go to school through work could be adapted to my being a night owl and waking up late.
Yeah, and that might explain the prevalence of depression for these people who are forced into a world where that's not the case.
Fatigue.
You can't just adjust the world so that it fits your circadian clock. You have to adjust your circadian clock, which is your genetic, the way you are genetically, to the world, which could be a reason for depression. That would make sense to me.
Kind of anecdotal, obviously, here, but my wife has a colleague who's working remotely as a result of the pandemic. And because of the communication tool that they all use to chat with each other, she can now see that he logs into work at 9 p.m. and finishes at roughly 5 to 6 a.m. And it sounds crazy, but it seems to work for him.
He doesn't have to do the night shift, but he just does it anyways.
Yeah, he loves the night shift. Okay, last one. Little brain research. We're just talking about sleep. And this is an interesting study out of Canada, and it has to do with something I'm sure most of our listeners have heard other people talking about, which is the idea that you get older, you know, you start to forget things, your brain's not as sharp as it was before. Maybe you're worried about neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, dementia, and you think, you know what,
I'm going to... Just play Sudoku.
Yeah. Do the crossword puzzle every morning. I'm going to keep my brain active and fit and, you know, keep my cognitive abilities way high so that I can, I don't know, prevent these diseases from happening in the first place or deal with them better.
I think we've got some bad news coming. Is that right?
We do. So Canadian researchers, via online surveys and quizzes, wanted to figure out if you're one of those people who sit down and do these tasks, whether it's puzzles or logic-based tasks, verbal tasks, memory tasks, if you do those on a regular basis, is your brain in better shape than somebody who doesn't do any of those things? So they had 1,000 people who do these kinds of puzzles all the time. The average was they've been doing them for 8 months, but some people had just started 2 weeks ago. Some had been doing them for 5 years.
Give me the answer.
There's no difference.
Whatsoever?
There's no difference between the cognitive abilities when it comes to puzzles, logic games.
Oh, my God.
There's no difference between people who train their brains to do this every single day and those who don't do any of that. So they compared these 1,000 people who do these puzzles all the time to 7,500 other people who don't. And it sounds like, as far as I can tell, the researchers really tried to find something meaningful in the data. So they went back after they found that everything was basically equal and that there was no difference. They went back and took a look at the group of 1,000, the people who do these games all the time, to figure out, okay, but is there an age group that, you know, see some cognitive improvements as a result of all these tasks? Is there a sociological factor? Is there any group in this data that looks better than the other 7,500 people who don't do any of these games? No. None.
Oh, man.
So I guess for all, it's kind of sad news or funny. It depends how you look at it. I guess what it suggests to me is if you're one of these people who are doing puzzles to keep your brain sharp, in quotes, just know that doesn't work, unfortunately. But if you like doing crossword puzzles, I like a good crossword puzzle once in a while if it's not too hard and makes me feel like a fool.
Yeah, if you're good at it. Yeah,
yeah, no, a lot of them are really hard. So if you enjoy the challenge, if you're aware of the fact that I'm doing this because it's fun and I like it, that's great.
You probably get a nice reward, a little dopamine kick if you kill at a game of Sudoku or a crossword puzzle. That's fun.
Now, and I didn't...
But
I
it will not make you a smarter person.
No, there is a lot of research out there suggesting that if you're looking for cognitive improvements over the long run, that exercise is one very good way of going about that. It's not the only way. So I suppose one conclusion you could draw from this is if you have a limited amount of time, even if you're retired, if you're a busy person, and you've only got 30 to 45 minutes or an hour a day to keep your brain sharp, that rather than sitting in the reclining chair and doing a bunch of puzzles, go for a walk. Hop on a stationary bicycle, do whatever makes you happy moving, and that might be a better way to keep your brain sharp.
Science Unscripted.